Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture. And today I'm here with Mitzi Serretto, who is the author of the series, The Best New True Crime Stories. And we are going to talk about the sixth book in that series, Unsolved Crimes and Mysteries. Mitzi, thanks for being here with me today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I'm glad you found me.
So before we get into this book, this is the sixth book, like I mentioned, in a series. So could you just kind of sort of situate us in how you started to collect these stories and how this series came to be and maybe a little bit about the other books in the series?
Sure. Well, I started, I think it's probably be about 2.5 years ago now. It all sort of came about randomly. I've edited many anthologies in the past in different, you know, fiction and nonfiction genres. And it ended up being sort of a chance conversation with a former publisher of mine who'd gone to a new house. It ended up where I proposed some idea about doing a series of true crime books. I'll give you the chronology of each one and bring it up to the current one that we're talking about. The first one, yeah, they're all The Best New True Crime Stories. That's the series name. The first one was Serial Killers. The second one was Small Towns. The third one was Well-Mannered Crooks, Rogues, and Criminals. The fourth one was Crimes of Passion, Obsession, and Revenge. The fifth one was Partners in Crime. And today, the sixth one we're talking about is Unsolved Crimes and Mysteries.
So you have put this together, and before we get into kind of some of the stories in this, how did you go about kind of finding the contributors for this and picking the stories that you did? There's so much out there, so much unsolved mysteries and crime. So how did you go about kind of choosing the ones you wanted to include?
Well, first off, I send out, I disseminate my call for submissions very widely. For instance, there's a lot of websites that are interested in, you know, posting those things. I have a mailing list of writers that just gets longer and longer and longer as each year progresses. And so I'll blast it out to them. And a lot of things just get, as I've said before to people, that it just seems interesting how things get bounced around. I mean, I could have something that may have been posted somewhere and then it gets sort of duplicated and duplicated and duplicated. So I'll be hearing from people, you know, the call for submissions has all my specs, you know, what I'm looking for, you know, original new content, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'll ask people in the first instance to just give me a brief pitch. You know, maybe a couple of sentences really on a particular case that they might like to cover and what they're going to offer to that particular case. For instance, you know, some of these true crime stories, you know, a lot of true crime stories are really well known. So if someone wants to pitch something that is very familiar to a lot of people, I'll emphasize to them that, you know, you need to kind of give it a fresh spin, some new viewpoint offer in the story. or if you have a personal connection, even better. So, so they'll send me their, they'll give me their pitch. I'll say whether or not it sounds like it's interesting to me. That's not an acceptance by any means. It's just saying, hey, you've got my attention. I'd like to see it if you'd like to write it. So that's what happens. And then they'll start sending me their finished material. And I start looking at it and seeing what works, what doesn't work, how things fit within the bigger scope of the book. We go from there. Sometimes maybe I need to edit more heavily with someone, or we go back and forth on some, perhaps some avenues that they could explore a little bit more. It all comes out at the end. After everybody's hard work, we finally get a finished product, so to speak.
So in this collection, I think there are 15 different stories, right?
I think it's 15. Yeah.
If I'm counting correctly, yes. Yeah. So we have 15.
Yeah. Okay. I'll take your word, or I'll have to start counting.
we'll go with that. There's at least 15. How's that?
Yeah. That's sort of the average for each book. Some might be a little more. Some might be maybe one less. You know.
And one thing that I want to say that I really loved is that they're not all from the same century even, or same location, right? We've got stories from the United States, but also Canada, the UK, stories from the 1800s and 1700s, and stories all the way up to the past like 20 years, right? So you've got this wide range of stories as well that you bring to us in this book.
Yeah, I mean, it's really my goal to do something that's really has a good global appeal and really calls actually not a very good word to use, but takes material from all over the world and different time frames to really mix it up a little bit so that the reader is not just sort of getting the same thing, you know, like the same time frame or the same country all the time, because I mean we all know crime is not just exclusive to any particular country, and so I like to do it as globally as I can possibly get it within the confines of whatever I'm getting in from writers,
right? And you also it does not just focus on sort of unsolved murders, which often I think people think about, right, when they think about sort of these crime stories. Some of them you're also looking at as like robberies or different things like that. So can you talk a little bit about that choice too, to kind of like, I don't know if broaden true crime or broaden this idea of unsolved crimes?
Well, yeah, it's so true, because I mean, when we think of true crime, murder is usually the number one thing that comes to mind, and that does seem to be the most prevalent crime. You know, it's always murder, and so I kind of want to try to get something in the book that's going to offer a little bit of a break in between the murders, so to speak. You know, kind of a breather. So, I have a really cool heist story in here, the Montreal Museum heist. We've got a mysterious death of an actor. That's a piece that I wrote, actually, which we're never quite sure if he was murdered or if it was just some mishap. So that's an unsolved case, and it still is unsolved. We have a kidnapping of a schoolgirl in Rome. Never solved. We have what else do we have? We've got a historical piece about a man who just goes missing in traveling somewhere. He just vanishes, and it's sort of sparked a whole lot of mythology behind this story about this vanishing man. It's just really, really trying to give some sort of a variety without the same exact, same exact crime per each story, you know, because I think, you know, that would just be a little bit boring.
So let's talk about, I mean, like I said, there's 15 of these. So let's talk about a couple of them, and maybe starting with yours because you wrote it and you're here. So can you just tell us a little bit about the chapter that you wrote and that sort of unsolved crime and unsolved mystery that you looked into?
Sure. Well, my story is called In Heaven, Everything is Fine. And that is actually the name of a song which was used in the film in which this gentleman was in. And it was his first major role. And it's I'll mention that there is a heavy David Lynch connection. So that kind of should set it up that everything's surreal surrounding David Lynch. So an actor who's been in several of his films and television shows, obviously his death is going to be surreal as well. But the gentleman's name is Jack Nance, and he is probably widely known to people for being in the cult film Eraserhead, which is one of those films that once you see it, it just sticks with you forever. So Jack was, he got a lot of work from David Lynch. He was kept busy. But you know, he had his demons in his life. He had a very bad drinking problem. He ended up in rehab at one point. So that worked for a while until when his wife committed suicide, and that sort of set things on a downward spiral that he never quite recovered from. But anyways, he apparently was walking to Winchell's Donuts near his apartment in South Pasadena. And if anyone's lived in Southern California, they know Winchell's Donuts quite well. I was a big fan of them myself and a regular visitor. It was like 5 a.m. on a Sunday, and he's heading over to Winchell's, and apparently he gets in some sort of an altercation with a couple of young guys outside, a couple of Hispanic males, so he said. And he got a bit of a beating. And later that day, he met up with a couple of good friends of his for lunch, and they obviously saw that he was looking a bit worse for wear. And he told them about what happened, that he was heading off to Winchell's, and kind of got a bit mouthy with these guys. I guess he just took offense at their presence, and he got mouthy with them, and they kind of taught him a lesson. So then he kind of excused himself from lunch and said he wasn't feeling that great and he was going to head home. So one of the people that he'd had lunch with the next day just figured he'd stop over and check on him, see how he's doing. And he found him dead on the bathroom floor. This started this whole thing about, well, okay, he'd apparently been in this fight and he sustained some sort of head injury. And that looked to be what killed him. He definitely had a head injury. And that's what the coroner's report indicated. But the odd thing is no one seemed to be witness to this altercation. No one saw a thing, which is peculiar since, you know, you've got the donut places looking right outside. So if something was going on, people should have seen it. Nothing was picked up on any CCTV. No one saw anything. So hence the mystery. How did Jack Nance actually die?
Right. And there seems to be a lot of also rumor that has floated around about this. And like you said, with David Lynch kind of not being involved, but David Lynch being close with him, this seems to come up. The story doesn't seem to die either. It seems to come up every so often.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is bizarre. I mean, a lot of strange things were triggered by this death. For instance, apparently one of the actors from the Twin Peaks series, which Jack had been in Twin Peaks as well, this actor who was the the backward speaking man, I think it was, he went on some rant and said that David Lynch had Jack Nance killed. I mean, it's the, like, where did this come from? I mean, they had actually, these two men had worked together for 25 years and they were friends, not just professional colleagues. So there'd be like, there's no reason on the earth that you know, David Lynch would have his friend and his actor bumped off.
So you've got stories like this, stories where there is, you know, and who knows if any new evidence or any new information will come up, but this is something that people are still unclear of what happened. One of the things, pieces in here, one of the chapters I really appreciated, maybe that's the best word, is in a field outside of Edmonton, because it really looks at Indigenous women and what was happening to Indigenous women in Canada and in Edmonton. And then at the end lists a number of unsolved missing persons cases and unsolved murders of women, I think they're all women throughout this, sort of throughout Edmonton, throughout that area. So could you talk a little bit about that chapter and that piece?
Sure. That is written by one of my Canadian contributors, Janelle Comeau, and she lived in Edmonton for some time, so she was, you know, quite aware of this, and so she just got to researching and tracing all this, you know, historically over decades of these women, all of whom were Indigenous or mixed, Indigenous, white, and these women would just disappear. Some were found murdered. Some were found murdered in particularly horrendous ways. These were women who were also sex workers. And some of them had substance abuse problems. So when you combine all these ingredients, there just did not seem to be much incentive to look into these cases. I mean, she chronicles some pretty awful police work in some instances. And it's not easy. I mean, it's not easy going and investigating crimes when there is no particular, suspect, when it's just like a body is dumped or somebody's missing and you have no idea where to start. So, I mean, granted, that's understandable. But I mean, there were things where sometimes the police didn't even want to take a report. Perhaps they just, were dismissive because of the fact that these women were sex workers or they were known for having drug issues. And it makes you kind of question if there were several people at work doing these killings or if they might have been related to one particular person, like a serial killer, because that has happened in the past. It's just sad. I mean, she discusses some of these women, in more detail. Some of these women were, they were mothers, they had young children. The fact that they would just disappear like that was not normal for them. And family members would even say, look, my daughter wouldn't just take off. She's got a kid, she's, trying to get her life together. So it's just it's a real tragedy. And this is an issue that has been going on in Canada. And it's also going on in the United States as well. And there is getting more attention. More attention is being paid to this. But I think a lot of people still are completely unaware of just how bad this is. And when you look at the percentage of women murdered, for instance, in Canada, and then you look at the percent of Indigenous women, that it skews it way, way out of bounds. And it's just makes no sense that it's not being looked at much more deeply than it should be, than it is, rather.
Yes, and I really appreciate that has sort of brought this to light. And you talked about these connections, that some of the people have connections with the stories, whether they've lived there, whether they might be related to someone in it. And so there's another chapter, When Boston Turns Its Back, by Pamela Costello, which kind of talks about the same thing, an incident or two incidents in Boston that happened. And she talks about, as being from Boston, how they probably weren't given the attention that they deserve. So could you talk a little bit about that chapter too?
Yeah, I found a parallel with that as well. In this story, When Boston Turns Its Back, it's about a Swedish au pair who comes over to look after the children of a well-to-do family. And she is found, well, half of her is found, I believe it was. She was apparently cut in half and tossed into a dumpster. And the story really, really hits hard because Pamela, the writer, who is actually a Boston girl as well, keeps going on and on about the fact that, well, you know, she wasn't one of our own. It just seemed like, you know, the concern wasn't there, the attention wasn't there. And, you know, this was a foreigner who came over to Boston, she ended up murdered just last seen out for a night on the town, as all young people, you know, as Pamela says in the story, everybody does this on the Saturday night or whatever. They all go out to this specific area where the clubs are and the bars. And, you know, she just, the au pair was just like everyone else was. But when she was found murdered, there just did not seem to be the amount of outrage and constant, you know, getting her face out there. Can you find, you know, does anybody know about this girl? Does anyone know what happened? Did anyone see anything? And so again, it's that sort of the outsider thing. We're just not that bothered about you. You're not one of ours kind of attitude.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. And you mentioned too, so you have these kind of looking at how different people or different cases and people treat different cases. So you have that. You also mentioned that some of these are not necessarily murders. There you mentioned the art thieves, but you also have this really, I thought it was really fascinating, the chapter on Austria's Most Wanted, where you have this person in Austria who spends a lot of time planning his escape from prison and custody. So can you talk a little bit about that chapter too?
Sure. That story is called Austria's Most Wanted, 27 Years and Counting. And that's by Iris Reinbacher, who she's currently living in Japan. This is about a gentleman who is actually a Hungarian, and he had a bar in Austria I can't recall the city name offhand. It was a bar where, you know, you would maybe have ladies of the evening frequent and that sort of thing. But he just, you know, it was just a business for him because he was mostly interested in motocross racing, you know, motorcycles, and really kind of from positioning himself professionally in that, you know, as a motorcycle racer. So it was sort of a way to fund that love of his. So one of the women who frequented his establishment, who was also a sex worker, is she's found murdered. And so it seemed as if all fingers pointed toward Tibor, was his name, as the guilty party. I mean, everybody kind of chimed in, and they were just really, really trying to railroad him in as the culprit here. So consequently, through things such as sloppy police work and questionable police work, and perhaps even some corruption, he's convicted and he's imprisoned. And there he is, you know, kind of going along in prison year after year. And it ended up where he was going to attend university. And because he was such an exemplary prisoner, they allowed him to actually physically go to lectures and do his exams at the university. And I guess that was his, you know, he figured, well, okay, I'm locked up and I didn't do this crime. I didn't murder that woman. And so he orchestrates it through contacts of his that he's going to escape. So that's what happened. It was like no one believed he would have done this. The guards that he had, the prison guards who were with him at university, were kind of really stunned that he did that. So he apparently got it all organized, and there was a motorcycle waiting for him. He got on this motorbike and he just zoomed away from there, never to be seen again. So as the years progressed, they found, you know, information was forthcoming about things that were just highly questionable. You know, one of the police officers being involved with someone that just the whole thing smacks of a setup, essentially. And although there was an option for him to return to, you know, for another trial, he never took up that option, which, you know what? I can't say I blame him. I think I would have stayed underground too. So all this mythology cropped up about where he might be. Has he been seen? But it's an incredible story, and it's also an alarming story of how someone really, it's apparently just got set up for a crime that he didn't commit, and a terrible crime.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And now, I mean, you can go online. Like, one great thing about this book is like some of the stories I knew or was familiar with, but others I didn't. And you can go and see the pictures. And she sort of talks about that there's information out there and you can kind of see what he might look like today. So it's really, I don't know if fun is the right word, but I appreciated being able to like read these, but then also go and kind of explore a little bit more. And find out sort of what's out there about some of these stories as well.
Yeah, well, that's the fun thing. I've had readers tell me the same thing, that they got really caught up in this particular story and they just wanted to find out more and kind of put a face to the people and, you know, just kind of get an idea just to see a bit about where these things happened, what these people looked like. And yeah, I think that's great. I mean, if a story can get a reader interested enough that they want to learn more, hey, that we've done our job.
And you do have some that have a history of, you have a story here that involves crime bosses, right? John Gotti, some that are tangential, I guess, to the Black Dahlia murders, or like the example that something is like that, and others that have been a part of sort of popular culture and fictionized in different ways. And so that also brings in the audience and gets people really interested in what is happening, or, you know, some of these stories as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are there other stories in this collection that you want to sort of highlight, that there is something about them that you want to make sure that audiences know, or the know that are in here?
Well, you know, there's one thing that I've noticed. I was actually doing a virtual book event a few days ago with Joseph Beth Booksellers in Cincinnati. So I had a couple of contributors on with me, one of whom was Janelle, who wrote the Edmonton piece. And we got to the subject that there seems to be an overwhelming theme, and I did not intentionally do this when choosing stories and, you know, whatever, but in stories where the women are a victim, one just tends to see this kind of a little blame thing kind of overshadowing everything, that somehow you are responsible for your own disappearance or your own murder, that it was maybe because you were out in a nightclub, because you're a sex worker, because you were a bohemian type of person, a nonconformist. It just seems that this theme keeps cropping up when the women are a victim. And it's unfortunate, but I mean, it just seems like it's an inescapable thing when women are the victim, that there is somehow or other still this burden that they've in a way been responsible for what happened to them. And you just don't see that when the men are a victim.
Yeah, there's one in here about a young girl in Beverlywood, and they're, of course, looking also at, like, was it maybe her sister did something wrong? And so we have to invest, right, this idea that somebody had to have done something, quote unquote, wrong in order for this to happen, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was that was in the 1960s, and I mean, just like the writer of the story, Priscilla Scott Rhodes, she's mentioning like when the newspaper headlines, how they're putting a spin that, oh, she was a good girl, but then maybe they're leaving this sort of dangling thing that, oh, we might find out she wasn't a good girl, you know, things like that. That just would, if you were a man, it would just never in a million years happen.
Yes. And I appreciate too that there is an emphasis in many of these, especially some of the more recent ones, and thinking about what is this, you know, thinking about that these are people they have left behind, in some cases families who have just been tortured because of, right, the families who have fallen apart because of what happened. Even the first story in here, 25 years later, this AT lesbian double murder still haunts me, right, by Lindsay Danis, who kind of talks about like what was this like for these two women to be kind of outed after they died, and what that means for their families and their history as well. So there's that in here too, giving this real this other side to some of these stories that we often look at, and in a different light. You know, they give us like these are people, and they have sort of a history and a background, instead of sensationalizing them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's giving the victim some dimension, not just just a body with the victim sign on them. I mean, these were real people, and they had real lives. And sensationalism is something that I definitely run a mile from, and that's not something I want in my book series. So I'm pretty pleased that we've pretty much managed to avoid that, because I mean, that's one thing with true crime. Some people who maybe are want to dismiss it as being sensationalizing, and some of it does do that, but it's just not something that I've wanted to do. And I've been really, discouraging anybody from submitting any kind of material that sensationalizes. Because, we have to remember, these were real people. The victims were real people. The perpetrators were real people. And even if the perpetrators are monsters, they still have families. Some of these people have, spouses, children, parents. I think a little sensitivity can go a long way.
Yes, and I just want to say that I think that the chapters, the pieces in this book do a nice job of noticing that, right, and not going over the top and presenting information and things that people want to know about. Some of these, they're unsolved, right? They're crimes, they're mysteries. Some of them are still out there. There's still some of them are people are still looking for answers. So how do we get these stories out there? Maybe someone recognizes something. Maybe someone gets information without making these all about this sort of sensationalization of this sort of true crime things that are often coming up. Especially
yeah
now.
exactly I mean some of these stories might be pretty old and it may seem pretty far out to even think they'll ever be solved, but there's still enough of them in here that it is always possible they'll be solved. There's still people alive, and you know it could happen. So that was my concern when I was doing the book. I thought, oh my god, what if I get these stories by the time the book is published, what if it's solved already? You know, it's always the biggest worry.
Yes, I love that some of these have this caveat that like as of like, you know, 2021 or 2022, this has, yeah. You know, I always got to throw that in there as of right
I
now.
Actually, yeah, I actually said, you know, kind of encourage people like as of this, it hasn't been solved, you know.
Well, that's a question like, which is really interesting to like, you know, returning to some of those crimes, this is one of those things where you could return to it in like 10, 15 years and see what else is out there. What has happened from some of the, you know, some of these stories might have different things to add to them. So,
well, yeah. And with, you know, forensics now, modern day forensics, things have been solved, even like, you know, decades old cases. And, you know, so it's always a risk doing this, you know, unsolved crimes book. You know, seriously, I was on pins and needles thinking, oh, man, you know.
Well, one of the other things I really loved was that because some of these were older, it was not only like, here's what happened, but there was some discussion. I think it was it might have been the Beverly Wood one that I'm thinking of right now, where they talked about how they got the fingerprints. Or how, you know, like how they had to have someone who looks at every single fingerprint so they can't just run it through a system. And so there is this bit of history too in how of looking at the work of the crime scene investigators and how these kinds of things work. And like you mentioned, some that were just ignored, but others who did the best they could with what they had and how that looks different even 20, 30 years previous, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing when you think about it compared to contemporary forensic techniques that anything ever got solved in the past. But, I you know, because, I mean, imagine looking at a fingerprint, an actual image of a fingerprint, and having to find a match for that with your own eyes. I just can't even see how you could do that. You'd be blind after a couple of fingerprints. Compared to now, it just seems like such a dawdle now that, you know, it's all in a system or you can run through computers. And but, you know, it just shows you, though, I mean, that, you know, good law enforcement and good detective work is, you know, whenever it was, whether it was 50 years ago, 100 years ago or 5 minutes ago, you know, that's what it takes.
And so you have this series, right? You have this is the sixth in the series. And so we've been talking about this series for a bit and sharing some of those stories. So I'm going to ask you, what you're working on now, and I know you have a new book in this series coming out soon. So I'm hoping you can share a little bit about that. And if there's anything else that's going on that you want to kind of plug that you're working on, that would be great too.
Sure. Yeah, I know. It's trying to juggle everything because like here we were planning to do this interview today and I'm already like trying to, you know, promote the next book and it's like keeping it all straight. But yeah, book seven is called The Best New True Crime Stories, Crimes of Famous and Infamous Criminals. And that is actually coming out on Valentine's Day, 2023. I think it's just coincidental that it's Valentine's Day. But that book is kind of what it says on the tin, famous and infamous criminals. We've got celebrity wrongdoers. We've got, you know, actors, rock stars, business moguls, titans of industry. It's just all over the place. I'm quite excited about it, but you know, when it's a new book, you know, the next book's always the one you're the most excited about, and then you move on to the next one. It's like a band with their album, you know, it's the new album that they were excited about, it. And then the next one. So there's some really, really interesting stuff in there. There's some familiar cases to people, and some that won't be so familiar. And again, we travel the globe, so I mean, we've got American criminals, Canadian, British, Australian. So it's definitely an interesting collection. Some of the writers are people who have been in previous books in the series. I often do that. You know, sometimes people, they know what I want. They know what I like. They deliver the goods. So they get in more than one book, obviously. So as I said, that'll be out in the middle of February, and print and ebook, and possibly an audiobook. You never know. And other than that, what am I working on? I've got a couple of irons in the fire with possibly some anthologies, and I really, really, really am desperate to get back to working on my crime novel, which I have to keep shelving because so much stuff keeps pushing on, you know, there's just like no time to actually write. So that's, I'm kind of looking forward to a cold winter where I can just hide and do some writing.
Oh, completely understandable. Thanks so much. So Mitzi Serretto, who is the author of the series, The Best New True Crime Stories. There are 6 and soon to be 7 volumes that are coming out. And we just had a great discussion about unsolved crimes and mysteries. Mitzi, thanks for being here with me on New Books Network.
Thanks for inviting me.